Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Web3 Leaders podcast. My name is Colin Fitzpatrick, and today I'm delighted to have a fantastic guest on our podcast today. Very big welcome to Khalil, who is head of digital for Coca-Cola Bottlers in Japan. Khalil and I have kind of been virtual friends. We've connected over LinkedIn many, many times. He's a very significant LinkedIn contributor, posts a lot about Web3, AI, and many other topics. And I'm delighted that he has come on to the podcast to join us today. Khalil, very welcome.
Thank you for having me. I hope you have a lot of fun tonight.
Well, we've had some awesome conversations already in the past when preparing for this. And I do see your topics, which are extremely wide and varied and very, very successful, which we'll talk a little bit later about. Do you want to give a minute just to a little bit on your background and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, it's a good point. So it's been 8 years I'm here in Japan, so time flies. Before that, I was in Hong Kong, working in totally different industry on education. And here I came, I joined like WPP, like the media agency. From there, kind of like went into investment fund and end up working after a very short trial at entrepreneurship during COVID, not the best of times. At Coca-Cola Bottler Japan, where I lead data and digitalization, and enjoying it very much.
So Coca-Cola is obviously one of the very major brands in the entire world. I always remember 20 years ago or more, probably before Apple, my brother-in-law is a very smart guy telling me all about the story about how Coca-Cola became successful, also about how their brand is so valuable. And there's another topic that we'll get into a little bit later, which is around AI, because there was a fantastic podcast a little while ago to talk about how AI is almost like a platform in the same way that refrigeration was. And the point that was made was that the guys who invented refrigeration, they made some money, but who really made money out of it was Coca-Cola, because they used that to build an absolute incredible empire. Tell us a little bit what it's like working for such a massive brand and having such a big invisible role inside that company.
I think like the most important thing is that most people working for the brand is because they love it and they really enjoy like the drinks we produce and so on. And the connection with the consumer that we have built thanks to this brand. So in a way, we are all proud of working here. So we are all like kind of having fun just because we are here together with the same mission and values and trying to make the world a bit happier every day and a bit better. So I think that's the most important. The rest, technology, everything is just adding up for culture, as I would say.
What I loved the last time we spoke was we were talking about Coca-Cola in general and their strategy for obviously their massive advertisers and what that was. And you basically said to me that their strategy for Coca-Cola is just, we want to be present where other people are enjoying themselves. I just love that. I thought it was brilliant. Maybe tell us a little bit more detail about that.
Yeah, it's been like a few years now, but like everything is designed around moments, really, drinking moments. So, and that makes sense. I mean, what do we do every day? We like, of course, eat, but like, could we survive without drinking? It's something we can't do without. But we don't drink just to drink. We drink like for the pleasure of it, for sharing the moment, to be with someone, or to do something we enjoy, or just to keep, you know, time going. And that's very powerful. That's why, like, especially in Japan, it's broken down in hundreds and hundreds of brands that are only present here, actually. Japan produces the most in terms of like SKUs all around the world, and that's seen in the market because they love innovation and they want new stuff all the time, and that gives us also the opportunity to try new things all the time. But again, you need to reframe everything around the concept of happiness and getting closer, bringing magic to every moment you share, and of course, every moment you work at. That's what motivates me to be at the company today. But beyond that, I think it's very exciting to be in an industry that's seen a bit like a laggard I'm not going to talk a lot about Coca-Cola, but more about, you know, the whole CPG and, you know, the old guards that have been kind of like put aside and now they're coming back because of how valuable their brands are. But more importantly, they have something to say. And now technology can enable them to go faster and leap forward while, you know, tech companies kind of like built this infrastructure, as you said, like the foundation. I think a lot of brands that were kind of standing behind have this opportunity to take Web3, to take AI, to take all the new technologies that are coming and to reinvent themselves thanks to that. And that's what excites me the most, basically, in my job.
That's very, very cool. So before we get into that, because I do want to hear about how these, you know, very old and extremely well-established brands are really, you know, coming to the forefront of things like Web3. Tell us a little bit about how and when you got into Web3 and what your journey has been like.
I think like most people would have heard about Web3 thanks to crypto and the hype that's built up around it, which in a way, of course, it's the greed factor that's built up kind of momentum initially. When we look at it a bit deeper, it's about the aspiration that people are looking at for Web3. They want to get back control, have a certain freedom that were taken by like either, you know, big corporation or by like governments alike. And they all dreamed about this world where it's going to be all decentralized, where we can do things without like, you know, being controlled by others, where we can free ourselves and deploy this technology for good. I think that was the drive after the greed drive. Unfortunately, things didn't go as well because the aspiration didn't align with technology. Or just very early on, it's the same with AI. There's a lot of hype today. We expect a lot from all these tools, like GPT, one of them, that, you know, we're going to just transform the world in a week. Nothing gets transformed in a week. Nothing gets transformed in a year. Technology doesn't work like that. It needs to spread out. It needs to establish itself. It needs to embed itself in a more productive, you know, like environment. And that's just not happening yet in general, including Web3. So now we have the opportunity to kind of calm down, look at things in a clear mind and just do the right thing rather than just jumping on the first opportunity that shows itself.
Sure. I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, this hype cycle that we've been in around Web3, we talked about this and I read about this a little bit as well, where NFTs went completely bananas and then it's coming down. But I still very, very much believe in the technology. I see that Coca-Cola and many other big similar brands are actually utilizing NFTs for things like access, membership, etc. What have you been involved in and where do you kind of see it going over the next little while?
I want to talk about what we do here. As you can imagine, like, well, this is kind of under wrap for various reasons. But I would say that in general, blockchain has been utilized quite heavily and extensively in everything related to logistics, quite widely. But still has not been established yet as it should be as a connecting kind of element. It's still within the walls of a company in the best case scenario with the consumers, but it's never with other companies yet or just yet. Sometimes it's a few partners, but it's really rare. I think that's where like bringing blockchain as a validation mechanism, as a like connection points can decrease the cost to serve and then make everything a lot faster and a lot smoother for everyone. More importantly, can unlock opportunities that were, you know, requiring very complicated contractual kind of agreements, things that you needed to build trust before you can engage, that needs years to talk to. But as long or as soon that the companies kind of moved already in that space and they establish themselves on a blockchain, then it's a lot faster, is for them a lot faster to engage with other companies that use it, are in the same kind of like networks and kind of like iterate on that sense. So I think that's happening and we happen like a lot bigger and wider, but it will not be visible. Like most technology or most infrastructure is just invisible. And that's what we want it to be. We want it to be seamless. And that will happen and we grow and will be basically embedded by countries themselves, like what's happening in India right now, where basically the whole logistic chain is being connected end to end. And that's amazing. And once that's done, the efficiency that we're going to bring to India is incredible, and it will help it to advance its industrial standards a lot more, a lot faster, and get closer to the competition. What's visible usually with NFTs, crypto, and so on is, you know, the big numbers, how much did you sell your NFT, or like how can we provide value to the consumer, which is true, it's important. But I think what's more important is to answer or create something that doesn't exist. Right now, we are kind of reproducing things because it's normal. Like, you start with what you know. But what's exciting is when the technology is established and stable, it's trusted, and like kind of like embedded in a massive network. Let's say Line here in Japan, that's launched its own NFT network as well. Then it becomes like really like a tool for growth. And that will be seen less with the wording like NFT and more like collectibles or just, you know, stamps.
Yes.
The thing that we know that are familiar to us, and we will just forget about that technology. Will people sell it? For sure. People sell, you know, collection cards and for you know, centuries. I don't think that will stop. It's just the format will accelerate. The volume will become much bigger, and the like format itself will evolve into something more dynamic, exciting. Yeah. I think that's where the value brands can bring through their own brand, but also through the, you know, IPs they acquire in order to drive their marketing in general. I think that's where it's going to make a big change in the next decade or so.
It's interesting you say that, because I mean, Steve Jobs is quoted on saying something along the lines of, any technology that is sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. And just like you said, it's like it'll disappear. I've always said this. I believe the word NFT will just fade out of the nomenclature, because right now it's how we describe a piece, an asset that is digital, that is obviously easily replicable, but has value. So we need to put that value on the blockchain and put ownership around it. People of our generation and older have, you know, a real hard time grasping that, but younger generations don't. They really, really see value in digital assets almost the same. We're used to buying something and getting something in our hand. I absolutely think that'll fade out. And I think that's the really important thing. Maybe tell me a little bit more about how you see this panning out for, you know, large companies such as your own or some of the other ones, utilizing things like NFTs to help with customer engagement, help with loyalty, under those other things, and then, you know, how that's going to pan out, you know, in the metaverse.
Thank you. I think like all the permission marketing that we were kind of building our communication around about 10 years ago, will come back in a form where everything will be gated in a positive way rather than a negative way, where you will have a personal kind of attachment to the brand or engagement that you build, and it will be recorded, but only you will know it. And if you authorize the brand itself. So you can do a lot of things with it. You can go to concert if they allow you to go to this concert, like exclusive things that can before required a lot of connection between CRM systems and, you know, ticketing systems and so on. NFT, what it is just a simple, basically, receipt that proves not necessarily the ownership, but proves that you have a right to something. That right is in a contract. That's a different thing that can be built up. So how we wrap all this is what's valuable. I think where the brand need to differentiate themselves is not in the technology itself, it's in the wrapping of it. What are they producing out of it? What are they bringing to the table? I think when you look at all the kind of like boom of AI music, here there is no choice anymore. If you don't put your voice and your creation on the blockchain, how can you prove it's your voice? Even that is this crazy. So, and we are like at day one of, you know, generative AI. Imagine like 10 years from now, what's going to be? It's the same.
So that's brand. quite That's quite fascinating. We've seen the videos coming out recently that, you know, you listen to it, you hear it, you're like, oh, that's the new song from Jay-Z or whoever it is. But it's completely AI generated. There's such a gray area about this. There's so many crazy legality issues. But how do you kind of see this playing out?
Like, look at Japan, look at China, look at the US before. Did they ask legality when they tried to, you know, leap forward and develop their economy? They didn't care. Sure, of course, law is important. Law is something you rewrite as much as you want when you have power. And that's people that will have the power to reshape this, probably the United States of America, just because they have so much IP and so much, you know, like economical kind of like pressure around. But countries like India that, you know, develop their own drugs based on existing, you know, patents without caring about it. Or Russia right now that just announced that they will not follow any patent of like people that or countries that are unfriendly to them. Or China that just like find their ways in order to reinvent, you know, what they see out there. But everyone does that. Everyone did that before. So you can fight it. You can complain about it. You can cry about it. The only way to protect yourself is to protect your interests yourself and put like, you know, a moat around you that is real and that's not imagined. And most people, they just like try to imagine themselves that they have a protection just because they say they own it. It's true, you own it. That's by law, it's yours. And people should respect that. But the internet is the internet. People will do crazy things, either you want it or not. So you better live with it and protect yourself in a way that is meaningful, meaning beyond the blockchain, start preparing the technologies that necessary to kind of deal with all, you know, the hacking or the misuse of AI, put strict rules around information security in your company and protect your data, first party and zero party data as much as you can, because that's going to be the most valuable thing. That will be what's differentiating. The whole data out there is out there. You're going to be captured. You can complain about being scrapped or not yours and so on. Companies will scrap it anyway. So that's not going to change anything. What can change is protecting your own data. So I think that there will be a kind of a reversal where we will look at the available public data as something like a commodity of low value, while what's interesting is what's unique and there it's yours. And that's what we should be protecting and building upon a lot more.
Very interesting. I mean, we talked about this before. One of the major issues that Web3 has is that, let's face it, it's reasonably technical. It can be difficult to understand. And we see this all the time in people's lack of understanding about blockchain or about Bitcoin or specifically about NFTs. I hate the way people just think, and Bill Maher was talking about it the other day on his show. He was talking about, oh, well, hang on a second. Someone paid $200,000 for this Bored Ape and I can just screenshot it and I have it now. And, you know, they just don't really understand that. But the other issue is that, you know, ChatGPT launched and got 100 million users in a couple of months. You know, we all talk about how we onboard the next 100 million users into Web3. They didn't have to onboard anyone. They just created an amazing product that was simple to use, that you did not need a manual. You didn't have to watch YouTube videos to understand. You just started using it and it was brilliant. I still think we're kind of waiting for that, you know, iPhone moment, as a cliche phrase, as to happen. Because now what we have seen is we've seen Twitter do a deal with eToro to enable their 300 million users to very easily purchase Bitcoin, Ethereum, and other cryptocurrencies. I think that's going to be a major step. Hopefully they will integrate it so that I can just send, you know, my whatever coin to @Khalil on Twitter. And we need to get rid of this 24 string of random characters. It's quite ridiculous. But what eToro do is, you know, it's not proper self-custody, you know, and that could open us up to another FTX. I'm really interested in how you know, we can push the industry into making things more simple, into making it just a very, very easy process for your average person to do that, but also to create things that will bring them in. And if we talk about the metaverse right now, and we've talked about this before, there's not a lot there. You know, it's a lot of gamers building some stuff. Maybe there's some events and concerts, but what is it that is going to be the catalyst to maturing these technologies of Web3 so that your average person is a lot more engaged?
I think like what we have already, I think that's where OpenAI got it right. They kept it simple. They just put a, you know, like a simple box, enter here, chat with your computer. Is what Google done before. They put a box, enter a keyword, and then that's it. You have your answers. They didn't try to put like some very complicated, complex three layers, innovative, whatever, like sci-fi technology as a UI or a point of entry. They just kept it simple. And what do people usually do on Metaverse? They just try to do it as complicated as possible, try to replicate life itself and the universe, which is just crazy. There is not enough compute power to run like a, you know, a copy of our room in your computer. So why are you trying to make it like that you can replicate a planet or even larger? It's just not realistic. So keep it simple, try to go back to the basics and try to deliver simple value that is scalable. Like if you try to build words, that's not scalable. How much money are you going to burn in there? Who going to use it? Why are they going to be there? There's no point. But we do have a word here. We live in it. We just augment it. And what will make it a lot more, you know, richer is basically something we have already, our phones. Yes, yeah. It'd be great if we have, like, you know, new hardware in the form of, you know, glasses, even better, in the form of lenses, even more like connected to maybe our brain, but that's a stretch. But we already have our phones and we already play, you know, AR games, and we already use AR lenses every day. Billion of people use AR lenses filters every single day. Because of that, you know, like all these AI filters could develop. Without LiDAR, they could not have developed so fast. Without all these people that are sharing, you know, their faces using all these filters, of course, they would not have been able to train this AI. And that's where the value is. I think this generation of phones that are arriving or just arrived will make a big difference in terms of, you know, developing a layer that's visible, that's valuable, that adds basically potential to the world we live in. I think that's where the brands should be. And that's where I would like to be definitely investing.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see this is that, okay, the metaverse has had its very, very fast hype cycle, accelerated greatly by Mark Zuckerberg, you know, renaming Facebook to Meta. And then I think everyone just sort of got bored after 6 to 12 months and they're like, you know, where is it? You know, I mean, I have an Oculus Quest. I've used it a handful of times. I'm not much of a gamer. I believe that the technology just has to really get to another level until it becomes a little bit more mainstream. Hopefully Apple will come out with that, you know, mixed reality headset and it'll be brilliant. And it'll follow by when you have a pair of glasses that are normal and not annoying to use, because let's face it, no one wants to walk around with a brick on their face. When you have a normal pair of glasses that will augment digital information or images into your eyes, or as you said, and I know someone doing this, developing a contact lens that gets inserted into your eye in the same operation as cataracts, which is the most popular operation on the planet. And then you will live in it. And I think until that, you know, it's not really going to go away. But, you know, what's your opinion on these hype cycles and how both the media and the public really react to this new technology that just really takes time to mature?
I think it's just fine. You know, hype is part of life. People get overly excited about everything and then they calm down and forget about it and move to the next thing. But builders, you know, product owners, the guys that, you know, create these ones, they don't care if it's hyped or not. But usually the hype also brings some value in terms of interest of some investors. It could be like maybe too much too fast, but the serious investor will stay around, will stick around, and we'll see the how to connect the value of this hype to something a lot more grounded and being productive. I think this is already happening right now. You can see it all over the place within like big corporations that they are trying to roll out their own program, loyalty programs that are around basically Web3, or try to replace their, you know, aging SSOs or like, you know, login mechanisms with something in between Web2 and Web3, which I think this is where we need to focus more. The bridge between, you know, fully decentralized and the world of today. And something in between is what will make things happen, because no one will create like a bunch of wallets and move around and try to, like, do you have the same wallet as me? That's stupid. But that's how people don't remember. The mobile phones were like that. I can only call the person that has the same, is on the same network. I can't call the other people. People totally forgot that it was this, you know, siloed before. But it took not like 10 years. It took like 20, 30 years to really now have this, I can call anyone even on the moon today. It's actually easier to call someone on the moon than on the jungle. So people forget all
that. Is a very good point.
It's really tricky because technology, of course, accelerates, but the adoption of technology, actually, the more exciting and exhilarating it is, the slower the implementation of it will be, because it's disruptive, because it changes too many things, because we have so much CapEx invested. What are you going to do? You're going to throw away all the CRM systems, you're going to this loyalty program that you implemented. It's not realistic. People will not throw that. So why crypto is not booming and working? Because crypto started fighting the banks. It's totally stupid. Why? You're going to throw away hundreds of trillions of dollars just because it's cool to be free? Let's be realistic. Play with the rules, play with the game, play with the gamers and then and the players, and then get your seat at the table. I think that's people try to get it now and need to stop fighting kind of, you know, the existing, or rather build with it. And then little by little, it will disrupt itself. Like the old guys will become the new guys. It's either that or they will disappear. Like all the old companies that did refuse to evolve.
Yeah, I look, it's hilarious what you say there about, I do remember that the very, very early days of phone networks, and you could only call someone in your network. And that's basically where we are with wallets. You know, I still think it's ridiculous having to pick a chain and, you know, make sure that the wallet address is for that specific chain. I mean, I'm pretty experienced. I send money around on wallets, not necessarily every day, but several times a week, you know, minimum. And I've been doing that for years. And I have accidentally sent quite a large amount of money to the wrong address or on the wrong chain. I did get it back. I was very, very lucky. But, you know, this is the reason that I won't let my wife manage our crypto money, because if I can make that mistake, she could definitely do it. You know, I got her set up with her own wallet with a, you know, a small amount of money in there, and she's playing with it. She's things like that. But until we really get over these problems, I don't see how the industry can rapidly advance. We've got to solve these issues. I mean, like you say, they're not going to happen overnight. They do take time, and the younger generation will get used to it. But we certainly need to solve some fairly fundamental problems. I mean, go back to the very, very early days of the internet, and it was significantly more clunky than it is now. But there are people, you know, working to solve these issues. And I think we will see a bit of a transformation over the next couple of years.
I think that will happen anyway. If you look at things that we do every day, probably you're emailing more than any other, you know, using any other form of communication. And email looks like a commodity, but like to run it takes a huge network, a lot of protocols behind, security, and so on and so forth. Again, it was not the case, you know, before. You had spam all over the place. It was easier to get scammed before than it is now. Actually, it's much safer now. But before, you had to set up your own, you know, email server, and like, you know, put all the setup for your own email address and make sure that like actually you didn't forget to pay for it, and that like the receiver is actually not in a country where they block certain email addresses or email providers. And then like you're a company, you send emails, you have to batch it and so on and so forth. And all that was a lot of manual setup. It was really painful. If you look at it, it's exactly the same what's happening with WebQ today. So just we are not yet with the right tools and we're not with the right mindset. So we need to change our mindset and start developing the tools we need rather than the tools we imagine that we need. So I think that's the problem. People want to get rich fast and forget that we just need to solve simple problems, and these simple problems will solve bigger ones. So like I was writing just a couple of days ago about what it takes to build just a pen, to make a pen. It's like thousands of people all over the world involved in order to make that happen. So imagine what it takes to build a whole network from scratch. It's like the same as what it took to build, you know, major banking institutions that could trade 24 hours a day, like across the planet. It was not simple. And all of these are running on old technologies, but they're all realizing that they need to upgrade all this. And they realize that they need blockchain, of course, but they don't want to be disrupted. So they go to the pace that they can control. So either we help them go to a faster pace within that realm, or we will just basically be, you know, the fun guy in his garage that's trying to change the world and tell people that alien exists.
Yeah. I mean, you said there that email is the tool we use most often, and it certainly is for most. Amazingly, you know, working in Web3, it's really less about email and it's more about Telegram and WhatsApp. For me, mostly the amount of business that's done on WhatsApp is insane. Mm-hmm. And Discord to a certain degree, although I really don't like Discord.
That's true,
I think that
again, you're living in your bubble, right? Your Web3 bubble. So you're limiting yourself. Most of the money is not in the Web3 bubble. Most of the productivity or workforce is not in the Web3 bubble. So you need to connect it to the existing world. And that's what's happening in big companies. Of course, I use Telegram, I use WhatsApp, I use all these tools. But at the end of the day, I won't Telegram someone from another company and tell him like, you know, like just like let's sign a contract here, where he doesn't know what Telegram is to start with. And how do you sign a contract on Telegram? Do you have a way to do that? No, you don't. You would have to go either like on blockchain system or use a digital contract tool. But the reality is big companies, they need to go through legal procurement. All these people have a role to play to make sure that, you know, you don't end up paying someone that will just run away with your money, buy some Bored Ape and then get jailed in next day.
I think for me, what's interesting is how the conversation changes depending on the platform that you're engaged on. So emails are a very formal type of communication. It's just a electronic letter. You know, you make your entire point, you send it off, and a few minutes or a few hours later, you get it back. And I remember trying to explain this to people when WhatsApp first came about and I discovered it, and I probably had about 4 contacts that are in my address book. That's how new it was. It changed the game completely from texting, because texting is you write this message and you send it off and then you wait till you get one back. But WhatsApp changed it into a conversation. You can see when the person is typing, it's more engaging. You can send other media as well. And obviously that is, you know, what it does. In the world of Web3, it's an awful lot more informal and it's a very flat organization. You know, you can talk to very senior people very easily. And it's all about groups. And then everyone's in the group and everyone's sending short messages. It's not this massive thing, or it's not, okay, we're going to have 28 slides in PowerPoint. It has changed it. And what I kind of wonder is how is that going to migrate, or are, you know, large companies like you and me have worked for all our lives, will they become a little bit more like that in the long run? Is that just the way humankind is going?
Well, I tell you, like in the teams that we have, of course, we like small scale, we can do that. But the value, well,
Slack, you know, yeah, Slack is like
Teams or
very much.
This is what it is. Like you discuss, you just drop basically a screenshot, fix this, do that. You don't write like essays to just explain, you know, like a simple change. But when you're building big things, it does help. And I think that's why we are on LinkedIn and so on. It does help to just sit around, think a little, write a bit longer. Why? Because writing helps you basically architecture and structure your ideas, but also explains it a lot more precisely so that people don't need to imagine what's in between. So there is a very big issue in Web3 because people think that they understand what the other person is saying, but it's not really the case. Why? Because they don't give enough context. There is not enough documentation. That's why, like right now, bigger, you know, blockchain projects are a lot more looking like DevOps operation today. Why? Because it's the only way to structure and build things properly. You can't build, you know, like a skyscraper on, you know, sand. Sand is cool. You can do a lot of things with it, really grass, but you can't build like a huge infrastructure. So both of them are needed. It's not one versus the other. It's both together. And just people are just like choosing sides. I don't know why. I think they just need to chill and work together.
So let's talk about LinkedIn, because that is how we got connected. You post a lot of extremely high quality content on a very regular basis. I've began my journey of creating content on LinkedIn a couple of months ago. It's been a brilliant journey. I've really enjoyed it. And exactly as you say, just forcing myself to write, you know, it's the first thing I do when I get into the office every morning. I collect things in the evening about things I want to talk about, and then I get in and I write. And it's not long. It's, you know, 400-600 words, maybe a bit more maximum. But I found it really interesting to do it because it collects my thoughts and it is an opportunity to put some out there. I've worked in the industry for quite a long time. I've gathered some knowledge and, hey, let's share it. And some amazing stuff has happened. I mean, a little while ago, I made a post about Twitter and eToro, like I mentioned, and I got a TV station going, hey, we liked your post. Will you come on and talk about it? You, on the other hand, have been far more successful because you had a wildly successful post a little while ago with what, 4 million views?
Yeah, about that. Like,
tell us the story.
Well, I was basically about to finish 1 year posting on LinkedIn. And the point behind it was not really like to just get like impressions. To be honest, I don't care about it. It's really about learning and connecting with others, and more importantly, improving my writing and seeing what are the demand levers and drivers. That's something I focus on quite a lot, on analytics, to find what drive basically attention, what get me attention, and what can I do to turn that into, you know, revenues, profits, and so on and so forth. More importantly, create new relations. So being close to celebrating that 1 year, I thought it would be interesting to use all the best practices to just craft the post that would be viral to see if we can get it there. So I tried a few of them, not only one. Some of them got 300,000, some of them got 60,000. So it always works, but at a certain extent, it stops after a while. This one just kept going. And it had nothing to do with my initial intent. I thought it would be quite successful and probably reach a million. I was not surprised when it did reach the million. I was like, yeah, that's not surprising. But then it kept going. And I was like, okay, that's interesting, because usually LinkedIn, after 2, 3, 4 days, basically momentum stops and just drops. What was interesting, it was like basically going up and just a little bit down, but like a new group or cohort of users would start engaging with it and would like basically take it again for a ride. And I think that's what's important. It's basically when you get to a certain ladder, you're activating a new network within LinkedIn that basically drives like engagement to the next step. And people liked this post because it was short to the point. The copy was kind of like not explanatory, but rather adding value to the meme, because like that's what it was. And that everyone could identify themselves in it. Like, I would be curious to see one person that works in a corporation, a company, or a project that didn't feel that, you know, the guy that pour water and put it back in the river and keep doing that over and over.
Do you want to explain the meme and a little bit what you wrote, and then your follow-up post as to how you dissected kind of how you actually built this and how you made it go viral?
I would say just go to my profile and look at it. I think it would explain itself. But basically, my intent was to use every step of crafting a LinkedIn post or a social post that would appeal to our, you know, own person. So I felt connected to that post. So I thought other people would feel the same. Because it's targeting project managers. So the post is about project management and how Agile is basically getting kind of like misused by especially big companies and consulting companies and forcing people into a mold that just doesn't fit, just doesn't work. So instead of helping them with a, you know, a great framework to achieve things and do it the right way and do it faster, what it does is basically just frustrate everyone, get nothing done, and just get people basically to turn in or against the framework, fight it, and then, of course, it's going to fail. And, of course, everyone identified themselves with that situation. It's not that the framework is bad. It's just most of the implementation of it are bad. So I just wanted to kind of carry that message. Seems like people agreed with it in the vast majority. Some people criticize it, but that's also part of the deal, actually. If you want something to kind of really go viral, you need, like, the, you know, both parties that interact with each other, and they did it. There was no, you know, ill intent or anger or anything like that. So it was really just funny. So people took it like that, and I really liked that people stayed polite and engaging, which is why I am on LinkedIn and not on Twitter.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So for those who haven't seen it, the video is a guy in a flood up to his knees, and he's got a bucket and he's scooping it up and he's throwing the water over a chain link fence, which is, you know, obviously ridiculous. But it says a lot about what we've seen recently in the tech market. All of these companies massively over bloated, Amazon, Facebook, you know, et cetera, trimming down their numbers by a colossal amount. Elon Musk came into Twitter, fired, I don't know, most of the staff. He still says it's over bloated. I mean, what do you think about the industry having too many people doing work that's just not really necessary, and where this is going to go?
Well, I think like it all came from cheap money. I mean, printing money day in and day out, making it that like it needs to go somewhere. So it's injected in the economy, in you know, jobs that actually don't add any value to anything. It's nothing new. This existed before, just the scale of it is much bigger because tech concentrated so much wealth. They had like really insane margins. So of course, they don't know what to do with this cash. And the only thing that they're obsessed about is the other tech companies that they might, you know, steal their lights. So they just hire everyone that they can just to make sure that other people don't, I mean, hire them, not hire the genius that will develop the feature that will make basically the next kind of step forward. And that's what basically happened. Like all these tech companies kept hoarding and killed basically most of the startups. Thankfully, a crisis came in, you know, they pulled kind of like a bit back. And that's where, you know, OpenAI, other startups like Midjourney and so on start appearing. Actually, this crisis or this type of crisis is where, you know, creators come in, is where, you know, creativity is renewed. So I think that right now when we are in the down cycle, that's where we will see actual disruption and great stuff happening. And I'm very much looking forward to it. I would say I hope that Google doesn't turn into a Yahoo. And that or AOL, and that they're going to get back on track, because right now they're really not doing the right thing for them.
Well, you talked about printing money there. And this is something I feel quite passionate about and read a lot, because there was a story last year that said 40% of all dollars in existence were printed in the previous 2 years. I've heard that that figure is closer to, you know, 70, 80, and I've even heard 100. I don't know what the real number is, but I think it's a completely unsustainable model. This morning, I was watching about how Warren Buffett is selling all of his bank stocks and getting grilled on it. And he's trying his best to be very political in his answers as to why he doesn't believe in them anymore. You got Gary Gensler coming out kind of going, oh, you know, he's trying to give some bullshit answer about if Ethereum is a commodity or not, or if it's an unregistered security. What do you think is going to happen over the next little while? And tell me your views on sort of Bitcoin in the long term.
I mean, all these are good questions. I would say that, you know, that we don't know the real numbers and that it's so complicated and it's all by design. They want this to be so complicated that it looks like only the feds can control this and only the banks know what they're doing and all the governments know what they're doing. I'm not anti-government, I'm not anti-Fed, I'm not anti-bank or any of that, but I am anti-bullshit. And this is totally bullshit, because what they've done is they didn't know what they're doing. They wasted like boatloads of money. They ruined the economy. They basically, sure, saved US economy by, you know, injecting infinite cash, leveraging the dollar dominance worldwide. But I can tell you, people in Bangladesh or in Morocco, my country, and others, they're suffering from this. The hyperinflation didn't come from just Russia, like starting a war. Of course, it is stupid too, but it came mostly because it's warped economic system that's being kind of like built on foundations that are totally shaky, and we're going nowhere. There is no one with a plan, and we just pretend that we have a plan, but there is no plan. The only plan is avoid the crisis. That's not a plan. That's crisis management. So I hope that they have something else in there. On the other hand, of course, we would like to think that blockchain and Bitcoin and Ethereum will come and save the day. I can tell you what they won't, for the simple reason that they are still part of this economy. What we need to solve is to turn the economy back into the right, you know, levers of growth, meaning being productive, not just print money or create stuff that are meaningless, or just, you know, build up financial networks based on, you know, just air. We need to go back to commodities and so on. And I think that's where the value will start to show very soon, where we will have like an explosion of commodity crypto, backed even probably by states that they will be pushing them. So I think that will give back some power, hopefully, to countries in Africa, in Southeast Asia, and that's in Latin America. That's a good thing.
So what about BRICS? I mean, I'm in Brazil right now. It's a formidable economy, and we're seeing Brazil, India, China, South Africa, Russia banding together to try and create a gold-backed currency. Do you think it has a chance?
I would like to say yes, but at the same time, they're not like the, how to say, most trustable people in the world either.
Yeah.
It's not that they're not coming with their own agenda. So I would say, for one thing, I don't think politicians will come up with any solutions as much as I want them to. So I think that's actually corporations and smaller startups like OpenAI that will come up with new ways to recreate our economy rather than like just laws that we will try to push them, to be honest.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, we're pretty much out of time. So, Khalil, thank you so much. Fascinating conversation. I would love to continue it. We will have you back on again for sure. And everybody should go and subscribe to and follow Khalil on LinkedIn. He posts some awesome content. And yeah, you're going to have to show me what I can do to get a million views, because I'd love that to happen one day.
We can make it together. No problem. But I would love to chat with all your network. So please reach out to me. And if you have ideas, please bounce them. If you want to work together as well, please talk to me. Thanks a lot. Have a good day or good evening, guys, and talk soon. Cheers.
That's brilliant. Thanks, Khalil.